From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's being called the biggest influence peddling scandal in a generation. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the ongoing investigation into lobbyist Jack Abramoff. We talk with Philip Sheenan, who's been covering the story for the New York Times. Last week, Abramoff's business partner, Michael Scanlon, a former top aide to Representative Tom DeLay, pleaded guilty to conspiring to bribe government officials and defraud his Indian tribe clients. Scanlon has agreed to cooperate with prosecutors. The investigation has broad reach into members of Congress and other officials. Also, music critic Marlo Miles reviews a new reissue of a solo album by record producer John Simon, who worked with the band in Blood, Sweat, and Tears. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We admit we've been having trouble keeping up with the Washington influence peddling scandals. The ongoing investigation into the lobbying activities of Jack Abramoff and his partner Michael Scanlon is heading in so many different directions and involves so many other people, it's hard to keep track of. But this story is fascinating on a purely dramatic level, and more important, it reveals some of the seamier side of today's politics. We asked Philip Sheenan to map out the story of the Abramoff-Scanlon investigation. Sheenan is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's been covering the Abramoff-Scanlon story and the investigations into former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Scanlon is a former aide to DeLay. Philip Sheenan, before we get into all, or at least some, of the details in these various, lobbying investigations, why is this larger story important? I mean, it takes some effort to follow these stories. Why is it worth it?
It's worth it because, you know, it's been a concern for a very long time that money buys too much access in Washington, that lobbyists have too much power, that the revolving door between Capitol Hill and the lobbying community is spinning much too fast and involves much too much money. And there are many people who would tell you that the saga of Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon tells you that things are out of control, that money is having too much influence on public policy, that members of Congress are offering themselves up to do favors for lobbyists in exchange for gifts that may well constitute bribery. That something needs to be done. And I think people are talking seriously now about new legislation that will place much tighter restrictions on what lobbyists can do and what congressmen and other public officials can accept.
Well, last week there was what appears to be a very big breakthrough in the investigation into the Abramoff-Scanlon story. Michael Scanlon pleaded guilty to conspiracy to bribe public officials and defraud his Indian tribal clients. And he said that he would cooperate with the investigators. Exactly what did he plead guilty to doing?
He pleaded guilty to a conspiracy with someone identified as Lobbyist A, and Lobbyist A we know now is Jack Abramoff, to bribe members of Congress by giving them lots of gifts, jetting them around the world on exotic travel, sending campaign contributions into their campaign offices, in exchange for specific acts on Capitol Hill. That's something much more than a gift. That is bribery.
So before we get any deeper into what Michael Scanlon did, let's just talk briefly about who he is and how connected he is in Washington. How connected is he to Washington?
Well,
what is his place in that power structure?
He's not a particularly well-known figure. He just happens to be well-known to a handful of folks who are in power on Capitol Hill. He's a reasonably young man in his mid-30s. He's a Republican operative with some history here. He worked as the press secretary to Congressman Tom DeLay for a period of time. He was quite close to DeLay. He left that position several years ago and decided to enter the world of lobbying and public relations, where he hooked up with Jack Abramoff, who's really the focus of all of these investigations.
And Scanlon is a very wealthy man.
He is apparently fabulously wealthy. In fact, he was required under this plea agreement to give up $19 million, but it's not at all clear that will leave him broke at the end of this.
Okay, so now he's promised to cooperate with prosecutors, and the Washington Post in an editorial said that he may now be the most dangerous man in Washington. What makes him so dangerous?
Well, he knows the inner workings of the Abramoff lobbying operation, and he may well be able to finger individual congressmen for having taken gifts in return for specific acts. He may be able to identify members of Congress who were bribed.
Well, let's get to Jack Abramoff. What's his position in Washington politics?
Well, Jack Abramoff is likely to be remembered as the man behind the biggest influence peddling scandal that Washington has seen in a generation. And you may have to go back even further than that to find a good comparison. He was the lobbyist. He knew where the levers of power were on Capitol Hill and in the executive branch. He knew how to pull them. And he got what he wanted on Capitol Hill and elsewhere, largely by wining and dining members of Congress, by jetting them all around the world on these lavish trips, nominally for business. And in exchange for that, Abramoff got these jaw-dropping lobbying fees. We know that he and Scanlon, his junior partner, got something more than $80 million during a three-year period, 2001 to 2004, from just a handful of Indian tribes and their gambling operations. If you want to know about this sort of unseemly, unholy alliance between money and politics, Jack Abramoff is likely to be a poster boy for that.
Let's talk a little bit about this relationship that they had with Indian tribes who owned or wanted to own gambling casinos. What was the arrangement that Abramoff had with these Indian tribes?
Abramoff, in the mid-1990s, saw a real opportunity to start representing the interests of Indian tribes and their casinos all around the country, because they are just money machines producing billions of dollars in revenue a year. And he would pitch himself to Indian tribes as the man who could make things happen in Washington or elsewhere in state capitals, wherever the Indian tribes needed friends. Often the lobbying efforts that Abramoff oversaw were efforts to prevent a rival casino from opening, as opposed to getting a casino open, a particular casino open. And he worked out a fee arrangement in which he would take some portion of the money, but the bulk of it would go to what was described as a public relations operation run by Michael Scanlon. And of the, $80 million that Abramoff and Scanlon took in lobbying fees, most of that money, $60 million, I think, went to Scanlon. And the reason for that, I think people suspect, is because lobbying has to be declared. It has to be declared in financial records in the federal government. Public relations doesn't have to be declared. It can be done off the books, essentially.
So Scanlon was officially running a public relations organization as opposed to a lobbying organization?
Exactly.
Now, you had said that part of the problem with this casino scheme is that the Indian tribes weren't getting what they paid for. But on the other hand, it sounds like Abramoff and Scanlon got lawmakers, congressmen, to do favors for the tribes in return for free travel or payments to their campaigns. So in that sense, it sounds like the tribes got something.
They got what they paid for.
Yeah.
I think we can draw the distinction. In some cases, certainly early on in Abramoff's career, the Indian tribes did get what they wanted. In fact, my own newspaper did a story back in early 2002 on the front page about this incredible lobbyist named Jack Abramoff, who was reaping these extraordinary lobbying fees from Indian tribes. And the story quoted many of the Indian tribe leaders as saying what a terrific lobbyist Jack Abramoff was and how he was able to get for them exactly what they wanted. I think more recently the allegation is made that Abramoff and Scanlon, yes, on occasion could get things done, could get access to members of Congress, but in the end simply pocketed most of the fees they were given.
So who is now investigating this Indian casino operation that Scanlon and Abramoff ran?
Well, the principal investigation and the one that's caused so much alarm on Capitol Hill is one that is being overseen by the Justice Department that also involves the Treasury Department, the IRS, the Interior Department, a task force that includes a host of other federal agencies. And they've been running a grand jury in Washington for something more than a year and a half. And that is the grand jury that had whose investigation resulted in the plea bargain with Scanlon last week. There are other investigations. There's been an investigation on Capitol Hill run by Senator McCain of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee that has brought to light some of the worst abuses that have been associated with Abramoff and Scanlon. There were a series of high-profile public hearings over the last year. And, there are rumblings about other sorts of investigations being overseen by state prosecutors around the country.
My guest is Philip Sheenan, an investigative reporter for The New York Times. He's covering the investigation into lobbyists Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Philip Sheenan, and he is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and for the past year he's been covering various lobbying scandals, including the one involving Jack Abramoff, and including investigations into Tom DeLay. One person under scrutiny now in this larger investigation of conspiracy to defraud Indian casinos is Ralph Reed. And before we get specifically to what he's being scrutinized for, he's had a long relationship with Jack Abramoff. How far do they go back?
Oh, they go back to the early 1980s. Abramoff made his name early on in the Republican Party when he was the chairman of the College Republicans, which he made into a pretty potent force during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. And among the people he worked with most closely was a young man out of Georgia by the name of Ralph Reed. And the two men struck up an easy friendship. Reed apparently used to sleep on Abramoff's couch in Washington. Reed introduced Abramoff to the woman who would later become his wife. The two men have been very close friends for many years. After Reed left the Christian Coalition, he went back home to Georgia and opened up a lobbying shop and started doing business with Abramoff's lobbying shop. Abramoff's interest was in protecting the interests of his Indian tribe clients and their casino operations. And Reed was involved because he would oversee part of the grassroots campaign that would protect the interests of some of those Indian tribes. In other words, if a tribe wanted to prevent a rival tribe from opening a casino, Abramoff would work with Reed to organize what was described as a grassroots operation to block all new casinos in that state or that region. Reed obviously is a man who proclaims his opposition to gambling and insists that he had no real understanding that the money that was flowing to him from Abramoff was coming from Indian tribe gambling operations. But some critics of Reed find that a little hard to believe, especially given his long ties to Abramoff and the fact that Abramoff was known in Washington as Casino Jack because most of his business was Indian tribes and their casinos.
The critics who are saying that money from the casinos was indirectly funneled to Ralph Reed use as an example that Jack Abramoff used the group Americans for Tax Reform as a conduit to send money from the Mississippi Choctaws, one of Abramoff's clients, to the Alabama Christian Coalition. Now, was Ralph Reed tied in with that Alabama Christian Coalition? Is that one of the ways he might have indirectly received money?
That was one of the groups that was working closely with Reed to organize these grassroots operations to block new casinos from opening. So Reed would benefit from the money given to a third party through America. I say it's a confusing tale of the money trail. But the money would go from Abramoff's operation to Americans for Tax Reform or another group, and somehow indirectly this money would get to Ralph Reed, or so it's alleged.
And this introduces another character into the story, Grover Norquist, who's the head of Americans for Tax Reform. And Americans for Tax Reform is a group that is staunchly against taxes. Just about any tax you can name, they would oppose. But Grover Norquist is very connected in Washington, way beyond just the issue of taxes. Where does he fit into larger Washington politics?
Well, in the movement, among the movement conservatives, there are a few people who are more influential and have more friends than Grover Norquist. And Americans for Tax Reform is one of the principal private groups in Washington pushing for the conservative agenda, largely focused on smaller and smaller federal governments.
And how does Grover Norquist know Ralph Reed and Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon? Do they go back?
Yeah, they go back again to the early 1980s at the College Republicans. Abramoff is chairman. Norquist is a leader as well. Ralph Reed arrives at College Republicans as an intern, and the three men have forge a very close friendship that lasts to this day, as best we can tell.
So where does Grover Norquist fit into the investigation now? What activities of his are being scrutinized?
Well, I think the concern is that if there was something improper about the way Abramoff was underwriting these anti-gambling crusades in some southern states and in Texas, I think the concern is if there was anything illegal about that, the fact that Mr. Norquist's group was used as a conduit for some of those funds, that could bring him under scrutiny. Senator McCain, who has a long antagonistic history with Mr. Norquist, has attempted to get Mr. Norquist's tax records and has suggested that that is worthy of further scrutiny by the Justice Department.
And Grover Norquist is expressing his outrage.
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think we have any strong sense that Mr. Norquist is personally under scrutiny here. At this point, I don't think we know that about Mr. Reed either.
So they're not necessarily being investigated. They're just characters who are now, on the periphery of the story?
Well, that's a distinction. You know, all of these people are under scrutiny to the extent the Justice Department has a vast, vast record of documentation from Abramoff's office showing his connections with Reed, with Norquist, with others who are at least indirectly connected to what the Justice Department now describes as this effort to defraud the Indian tribes and to corrupt public officials. So I guess that means they're all under scrutiny.
Now, there's another issue related to this that Grover Norquist is involved in, and that's the group CREA, the Council for Republicans for Environmental Advocacy, a group he co-founded with Gail Norton, the Secretary of the Interior. Now, what is being questioned about this group?
The question is whether or not Abramoff used this small Republican group to get decisions made at the Interior Department on behalf of Abramoff's Indian tribe clients. And this was the focus of the final hearings of Senator McCain's committee several weeks ago. The question being whether or not Abramoff would use this group known as CREA, led by a woman called Italia Federici, who at one point was quite close to Interior Secretary Gail Norton, to lobby the Interior Department to get things done for Abramoff's Indian tribe clients. The Interior Department has a lot of oversight over Indian tribe reservations. And there's a lot of email showing that Abramoff would call this group CREA, and this group CREA would then call into the Interior Department and try to get things done, largely through the offices of the Deputy Secretary of Interior, Stephen Griles.
So this means that there are members of the Interior Department, including the head of it, Gail Norton, who might at some point be under scrutiny.
I think Senator McCain's staff has been very clear, and Senator McCain himself personally has been very clear, that Ms. Norton is not herself under scrutiny. I think a lot of questions have been raised, however, about the actions of her deputy, Stephen Griles, a former lobbyist himself, now a lobbyist again. And there were a lot of concerns expressed about Mr. Griles and his testimony when he appeared before Senator McCain's committee a few weeks ago. He suggested he treated Jack Abramoff as he treated all lobbyists. He did no special favors for him. He couldn't recall direct communications with Abramoff often. But in fact, the email traffic, again, from Abramoff's shop shows that there was a lot of contact with CREA, this group we were talking about, with Griles, suggesting that it was a much closer relationship. In fact, it became known at this hearing that, in fact, Abramoff had offered Griles a job in his lobbying shop while Griles was still at the Interior Department.
Let's get into another chapter in the investigation into Jack Abramoff. And that's a business deal that he entered into with Adam Kyden. They bought Sun Cruise, which was a fleet of casino boats. And they're charged with conspiracy and wire fraud in the purchase of these boats, the trial scheduled for January. What's this story about?
Oh, my goodness, the saga of Jack Abramoff, it goes everywhere. This doesn't directly relate to the influence peddling scandals in Washington, but Abramoff, you know, ever the wheeler dealer, decided to get into the casino gambling business back in 2000, and the Sun Cruise gambling ship fleet became available for purchase. And he and a business partner, Adam Kyden, sought to purchase it. And according to the Justice Department, they dummied up a bunch of papers that made the financing of the purchase possible. And that's why they have now been indicted for fraud down in Florida. Again, that does not relate to what's going on in Washington, although I suspect the Justice Department may well try to use the indictment down there as leverage to get Abramoff's cooperation up here.
And part of the intrigue around this particular case is that Konstantinos Boulos, who was one of the business partners that they bought this fleet of gambling boats from. He was murdered gangland style.
In the February 2001, sure enough, his car is pulled over and he is gunned down. And more recently, three men have been charged with involvement in that murder, and they appear to be tied at least indirectly to Mr. Kaden, Mr. Abramoff's business partner.
So Kaden may be implicated in the murder?
I don't think anybody's made that statement. There's certainly a lot of questions that have been raised. We do know that after the sale went through, there was very bad blood between Mr. Bulis and Mr. Kaden and Mr. Abramoff. And shortly thereafter, for reasons we don't understand at this point, Mr. Bulis is gunned down.
Now where does Congressman Bob Ney, a Republican of Ohio, fit into this story of the purchase of the Sun Cruise gambling boats?
Well, he has lots of ties to Mr. Abramoff and Mr. Scanlon. In the Florida situation, Mr. Abramoff was able to use Congressman Bob Ney, an Ohio Republican who is chairman of the House Administration Committee, to place into the congressional record statements praising Mr. Kaden and other statements condemning Mr. Bulis. And it doesn't appear that Mr. Ney had any real information about either of these two men, yet he was apparently quite willing to place in the official record of the House of Representatives these statements for Mr. Abramoff. And the question is whether or not he did that in exchange for some gift or a series of gifts that Mr. Abramoff provided him.
Philip Sheenan is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's covering the investigations into lobbyists Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon. Sheenan will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Anthony Trollope's satire of money madness, The Way We Live Now, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, in stores and online. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the larger implications of the Abramoff-Scanlon lobbying scandal. We continue our conversation with Philip Sheenan, who's been covering the story for the New York Times. And Milo Miles reviews a reissue of a solo album by record producer John Simon, best known for his work in the 60s and 70s. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Philip Sheenan, an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's covering the investigations into lobbyists Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon, as well as the investigations into Tom DeLay. Abramoff has a very interesting background that goes kind of beyond Washington politics. Why don't you give us a kind of sketch of Jack Abramoff?
Abramoff is born in Atlantic City. He moves as a boy with his parents to Beverly Hills, where his father works for Arnold Palmer, the golfer. Abramoff becomes very conservative as a young man. He goes off to Brandeis for college. He becomes influential within the College Republican operation on the East Coast, eventually becomes chairman in the 1980s of the College Republicans, makes these friendships with people like Ralph Reed and Grover Norquist that would pay benefits for decades to come. He goes from Washington to Hollywood in the mid-1980s, where he decides that he's going to follow his brother into the movie business. And he makes apparently quite a forgettable action movie in the late 1990s, or sorry, in the late 1980s called Red Scorpion with Dolph Lundgren, the action hero. In 1994, the Republicans take control of both houses of Congress for the first time in many, many years. And Abramoff sees a new opportunity to take, to cash in, if you will. He comes to Washington and he becomes a big shot lobbyist. He certainly has the connections all over Washington to get things done for corporate clients. And he becomes best known here early for his very aggressive lobbying on behalf of a tiny chain of islands in the Western Pacific called the Northern Marianas. The Northern Marianas are American territory, but they are not required to abide by many federal labor laws, including the minimum wage law. So what emerged in the 1980s were small garment factories. Migrant workers were brought in from places like the Philippines and China to make garments at much less than the minimum wage with none of the protections that workers in this country are entitled to in conditions that are described by human rights groups as sweatshops. And they were able to make these clothes and label them made in the USA. And this becomes an opportunity for Abramoff to prove himself as a champion of the free market, because the garment manufacturers hire him on to defend their interests, to argue that what is happening in the Northern Marianas is a petri dish of capitalism, a real opportunity to prove that markets work, and that the federal government's taxation policies are unfair. And over the course of several years, Abramoff flies out to the middle of the Pacific. Many members of Congress, including Tom DeLay, offers them, puts them up at luxurious hotels out there. The beaches are lovely out there. It's a very, very nice part of the world in terms of physical appearance. They play golf. They have a great time. And they see these garment factories and come back and defend the practices when they return to Washington. And from there, it was, philosophically, not much of a leap for Abramoff to start defending the interests of Indian tribes and their sovereignty in running their casinos and their freedom from regulation by the federal government.
Is there any implication that Abramoff did anything wrong with the Mariana Islands? Is what he did, above board?
Well, I think human rights groups would tell you differently, but I don't think that has been so much the focus of what the Justice Department has been up to. Abramoff did bring a lot of members of Congress out to the Marianas to see what was going on, but there is, in fact, in Abramoff's old lobbying firm, a document showing that contacts were made with the House Ethics Committee to make sure that these trips were on the up and up. I say, I think much more of the focus of the attention of the Justice Department and the criminal investigators is on what Abramoff did on behalf of the Indian tribes.
At the risk of confusing our audience even more, I mean, it's so challenging to cover the story, because there are so many different chapters and interconnections between people. And our goal here in this interview is to try to kind of connect the dots and tell the story in one.
Agree with you.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of trouble telling this in the newspaper?
I do. You're given 800 words, and it's very hard to get all this in. I've told my colleagues that if we could get Tom Wolfe to decamp from the Upper East Side for a couple of weeks and come on down here. This is sort of a bonfire of the vanities of Washington, larger than life characters, lots of money, fancy meals, excess. And it's a story that takes you all around the world to lots of exotic locations. You finish up in Margaret Thatcher's offices in London. You finish up on what are described as sweatshop garment factories out in a little tiny island in the Pacific. It's got lots of color, and it just has tentacles everywhere, and it is very difficult to compress into a daily newspaper story.
Okay, you have spelled out for us some of the practices that are being investigated now by various groups surrounding Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist, and his associate, Michael Scanlon. So what do you think are some of the larger implications of these ongoing investigations?
Well, I think the largest implication is that you could see members of Congress and other federal officials face real problems with the Justice Department, face criminal charges, that they accepted bribes or other illegal gifts from Abramoff and Scanlon. I think there's a lot of fear on Capitol Hill as to where the Justice Department is going here and what else Michael Scanlon may know. And I think there is certainly the understanding that the Justice Department might at some point be willing to reach a deal with Abramoff in exchange for which Abramoff would identify particular public officials who broke the law.
What is this story telling us about what lobbying is like in the United States?
I think there are people who would argue that this story is proof that things have spun out of control in terms of the influence of lobbyists and their money on the workings of the federal government. You know, your listeners may remember the last set of lobbying scandals in Washington, Abscam in the 1980s, Korea Gate in the 1970s, in which members of Congress accepted gifts, bribes, that caused some of them to go to prison. But if you look at the situation then, the amounts of money we're talking about were chump change compared to what we're talking about with Abramoff and company. You know, I think in Korea Gate in the 1970s, a lobbyist handed out envelopes filled with cash, you know, several thousand dollars, a couple of, you know, $10,000, $20,000. But that's nothing compared to the amounts of money we're talking about with Abramoff, who would spend $100,000 on a single trip for a single congressman to go golfing in Scotland, as apparently happened here once.
Is there an obvious line between what was legal and illegal in the activities that Abramoff is alleged with having conducted? I mean, like giving paying for a $100,000 trip for a congressman, is that clearly against the rules?
Well, like everything else, it gets a little murky because what Abramoff would do in some of these cases is, it appears at least, he would have money sent as donations to a particular charitable group, and then that charitable group would sponsor the trip. And congressmen are allowed to accept trips from legitimate educational and other sorts of groups. In the case of Congressman Bob Ney, who we were talking about earlier, who is pretty clearly referenced to in the indictment of Michael Scanlon, Abramoff arranged for a trip. I think Abramoff described it as being a $100,000 trip to Scotland for Congressman Ney and a few others, including Ralph Reed, who we were also talking about. And that was apparently paid for largely by a private charity that Abramoff controlled, and to which the major contributors were some of his Indian tribe clients. So the Indian tribe clients send money into the Capital Athletic Foundation, which is the charity. And this is the charity that then sponsors a trip for Congressman Ney and others.
It looks like we're not going to have time to talk about the investigations into Tom DeLay. I think it's just too complicated to bring in even more investigations into the story. But how closely linked have Abramoff and Scanlon been to Tom DeLay, and how does the investigations into Scanlon and Abramoff affect the investigations into DeLay, if at all?
DeLay's under indictment now in Texas on charges involving violations of the state election law, and that's unrelated to what's happening in Washington. But DeLay was Scanlon worked for DeLay for a period of, I think, a year or two. The two men were apparently, you know, reasonably close. Abramoff and DeLay were very close. At one point, Tom DeLay publicly described Abramoff as among his closest and dearest friends. And it's pretty clear from the record that Abramoff was the man who organized a handful of extremely lavish overseas trips for Tom DeLay, trips that have attracted the attention of the Indian Affairs Committee in the Senate and the Justice Department.
What is your approach to covering the story? On the one hand, obviously you're covering all the investigations, the hearings, and so on, but are you also kind of investigating independently, trying to independently get access to documents, or kind of go behind the scenes and break new parts of the story yourself?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I have trouble sleeping at night with the understanding that on Capitol Hill there are apparently hundreds of thousands of pages of Abramoff's emails documenting all sorts of things that I think we'd like to know about. And almost every day brings some new revelation about Abramoff and his lobbying. And there was a story a couple of weeks ago we had about how Abramoff had approached a small West African nation, Gabon, and asked for, apparently he was prepared to ask for $9 million on a lobbying campaign that would focus on getting a meeting for the president of Gabon with President Bush. We don't know in the end if that money was ever paid or if there was ever a signed contract, but sure enough, 10 months after Abramoff prepares the paperwork on this, who should appear in the Oval Office but the president of Gabon, who has a meeting with President Bush. And I think there's just an awful lot more about Abramoff we don't know, and we may know more soon, though this investigation seems to be taking its time.
Did you break that part of the story about Gabon?
Yeah.
And
I think there may be more to be coming on that front as to what other representation Abramoff had on behalf of small nations abroad.
What can you tell us about how you break a story like that?
Well, in that case, it was, you know, somebody presented us with these documents out of Abramoff's lobbying operation that showed this, you know, pretty brazen effort on Abramoff's part to get a big payday for largely arranging a single meeting at the White House.
My guest is Philip Sheenan, an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's covering the investigations into lobbyists Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Philip Sheenan, and he is an investigative reporter for the New York Times, and he's been investigating the lobbying scandals involving Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon. He's also been covering the investigations into Tom DeLay. How does the fact that several journalists have been subpoenaed and asked to testify, and in fact have testified, for the special prosecutor in the investigation into Valerie Wilson, how has that affected your sources' willingness to speak with you, and are you concerned that at some point you might be asked to testify in an investigation?
I don't know if I face in this case that possibility. I actually at the moment, along with my former colleague Judith Miller, there is an effort by the Justice Department to obtain some of my telephone records involving stories we did after September 11th. But apart from that, in this case, I think there is a chilling effect on all of us at the moment. There's a lot of nervous conversation when you talk with folks about the Abramoff investigation or almost anything else going on in Washington these days, with worry about what are the implications on the part of a source in talking to a reporter. I'll go to prison if need be if it's in exchange for valuable information. But I think the person who might provide that valuable information to me is having second and third and fourth thoughts about presenting it to me.
Right. There have been a lot of emails that have been used as evidence in this story. Some of them, I have to say, quite colorful and vivid in their language. Do you have any like favorite quotes from the emails that have circulated as part of the story?
Oh, well, you know, if you ever had worries about your private email becoming public, I think Abramoff gives you reason to think to worry even more, because Abramoff clearly lived on email. Every thought he had was expressed on email, and some of those thoughts were pretty colorful, and some of them were pretty ugly. And there have been emails that have come forward in which Abramoff and Scanlon described their Indian tribe clients as troglodytes and monkeys and all sorts of distasteful things. And there have been just in terms of, again, the brazenness of this operation, there's a lot of sort of locker room chit chat. You know, I want to get my mitts on their mullah. I want to, fire up the Jets, baby. We're going to El Paso to milk this deal. You know, I think this man put every thought onto a computer screen. And all of that is now available to the investigators at the Justice Department, and a lot of it is available to the investigators in the Senate Indian Affairs Committee who've been looking at Abramoff for a long time. And I think maybe one of the reasons we haven't seen a lot of that email is because it does involve serious allegations of illegal gifts given to public officials, and the Justice Department doesn't want that out because it is now pursuing those public officials.
Michael Scanlon, who we talked about earlier, has a reputation as a pretty tough guy, and he sent an email, and this was during the Clinton impeachment. This was right after, this was like the day that Clinton testified to the grand jury about Monica Lewinsky. And Scanlon objected to, quote, this whole thing about not kicking someone when they're down. You kick him until he passes out, then beat him over the head with a baseball bat, then roll him up in an old rug and throw him off a cliff and pound the surf below, !! With two more exclamation points.
They love those exclamation points, I promise you.
What role was Scanlon's role in the impeachment process?
He was part of the delay war room. I think for many prominent Democrats, a lot of scores are being settled here. I think Tom DeLay and company argue this, that the reason they are being singled out for investigation is because of there's some vendetta against them for their actions against Democrats in the past. But these are tough guys. These guys played for keeps.
Do you have a sense of how the Republican Party is being affected by the fact that Tom DeLay, the powerful House Majority Leader, is no longer House Majority Leader, and he's bogged down in investigations? Abramoff and Scanlon, who were really major fundraisers for Republicans, they're being investigated. How are these investigations, do you think, affecting the larger power base of the Republican Party or of the Bush administration in particular?
I don't think we know yet. And, you have to remember that the opinion polls showed that the public has held Congress in low esteem for many, many years. So the fact that there might be bribery and corruption on Capitol Hill, I don't know if it comes as a great shock. And I don't know how it would affect the overall election results next year or in 3 years. The concern on the part of a lot of Republican strategists is that some of this at some point is going to take. I don't know if the criminal case against Tom DeLay in Texas, for example, I don't know if people in the public can follow that. It's a rather convoluted tale about violations of state ethics laws. But, this week we had a plea bargain by a member of Congress, a Republican from California, Duke Cunningham, who acknowledged taking, $2.4 million in bribes, and this included things like a Rolls Royce and an antique toilet and a yacht that was apparently called the Dukester. I think some of that probably is memorable detail that voters might remember next year when they cast their ballots. And I think in the case of Abramoff, the excess is so great and the details are so delicious often, that people might remember that and wonder whether or not there's a larger problem here. I think we're going to hear a lot in the future about Abramoff's restaurant in Washington, which is called Signatures, one of the most expensive restaurants in town that Abramoff used as a second office, and at which he would, wine and dine members of Congress every night to an extraordinary degree and comp them. He wouldn't charge them anything for that. And I think when we find out exactly how much champagne Congressman X drank and how elaborate were his meals with his wife and children and best friends, I think some of that detail may be pretty memorable to a lot of people. And I think then we could see some effect on the larger election results.
Where are we now in the investigations into Abramoff and Scanlon? Like, what's next for both of them?
Well, Scanlon's agreed to cooperate, and to some degree he's been cooperating apparently for several months. And I think we're waiting for many shoes to drop. I don't know if we have any strong sense that there will be additional indictments soon, but I think we're going to see additional indictments down the road. Otherwise, the Justice Department wouldn't have sought out a deal with Mr. Scanlon. Obviously, they consider his testimony useful in bringing down others. I think there's an understanding that some sort of action against Abramoff is simply a matter of time.
Philip Sheenan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Philip Sheenan is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a reissued solo album by John Simon, who produced hit records by Big Brother and the Holding Company and the band. This is Fresh Air. During the 60s and 70s, John Simon was a record producer with such hits as Music from the Big Pink by the band, Cheap Thrills by Big Brother and the Holding Company, and Child is Father to the Man by Blood, Sweat, and Tears. He also made his own solo albums. His first, from 1970, has been reissued, and critic Milo Miles has a review.
When John Simon set out to make a solo record in 1970, he had a platinum Rolodex to draw on. John Simon's album, as it was called, featured players like Rick Danko and Richard Manuel from the band, Leon Russell, guitarist John Hall, and members of Derek and the Dominoes. Not surprisingly, the tunes on the album suggested several of Simon's clients, such as the band and Simon and Garfunkel. But Simon combined a sharp feel for 60s pop and rock with a range of musical interests that's almost unheard of today. Born in 1941 in Norfolk, Connecticut, Simon played piano from age 4 and led jazz bands in high school and college. He also showed a deep and abiding appreciation for Broadway numbers and the Great American Songbook. Simon has mentioned Hoagy Carmichael as a special favorite. Perception at the time was that pre-rock and soul styles had never been further away from pop hipness. But the Beatles and Beach Boys were always sneaking in pre-rock references, and Simon was already adept at it when he produced Simon and Garfunkel's Fakin' It in 1967. Plus, the characters in John Simon's album were total moderns, misfits and dreamers with their youth battered by tumultuous times. Still trying to remain hopeful, whether they were the motorcycle man or the fool dressed in velvet, or bruised, wistful Annie.
And Annie looked down at the city street that tempted off her husband, down past her several children. going through.
Simon's alignment of styles was hard to maintain. Even on his second solo album, Journey, the playing had become slickly jazzy, dreamlike characters become merely whimsical, and his delicate alienation slid towards sentimentality. Simon still makes the occasional album for his Japanese cult following, but they are very, well, comfortable and content works. He did arrange and produce one recent record I recommend, the charming and low-key Hoagie Land from 2000. It features jaunty arrangements of Carmichael tunes sung by John Sebastian, Steve Forbert, and others. Come to think of it, though, the old John Simon's album debut is just as timeless. It's an album Hoagie Carmichael might have made if he'd been in his prime in 1970.
Milo Miles reviewed John Simon's album, which has been reissued. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Once upon a time, in the land of rhyme, there was a ship at sail.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Retirement for Two, everything you need to know to thrive together as long as you both shall live, by Marianne Vanderveld. And from Warner Home Video, presenting March of the Penguins DVD, a family film about the journey that emperor penguins take in order to become parents. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In the new book, Off Center, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson write that the Republican Party has managed to oversee a major transformation of America's governing priorities, although they've ruled with only a slim majority. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Hacker and Pearson, and we talk with Trent Lott, Republican senator from Mississippi and former majority leader. Join us for the next Fresh Air.